This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the St. Louis Jewish Light, read by Terry Reitzel. As Ark of Pandemic heads the right way, synagogues start to reopen their doors. By Eric Berger, Associate Editor. Rabbi James Bennett of Congregation Sher Emeth has officiated more funerals over the past year than he has at any time since he started his career in 1984. And many of those were due to COVID-19. And while Bennett said he's excited to hold in-person services Friday night at the Reform Synagogue for the first time in more than a year, he also recognizes that mental anguish, anxiety, mental illness, loss, grief, fear, and trauma remain among congregants. I think we have to be patient with each other as we relearn and return to healthy human interactions once again, said Bennett, whose congregation will hold services in its outdoor garden or in its sanctuary in the event of inclement weather. Local Jewish congregations do not appear to be gathering in the same way as before the pandemic, but now that the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has changed its guidelines to allow vaccinated people to gather indoors without masks, Sher Emeth and other local synagogues are again cautiously opening their doors for Shabbat services. Central Reform Congregation is also holding in-person services this weekend for the first time since the pandemic started. Rabbi Daniel Bogard said, "Though there are some amazing things that have happened in terms of community during the pandemic, the people we've been able to reach and connect with and form genuine, authentic community with, I don't want to say that online is less than, but it's not the same. I am really excited for those first moments of being together." There is no uniformity in approach to reopening among synagogues. The organizations are working through the same questions as public institutions in other parts of life. Should we just gather outside? Should we continue to require masks indoors? Should we ask for proof of vaccination? Should we limit capacity and ask people to sign up in advance? Congregation B'nai Amunah has been holding limited capacity services indoors since October. The synagogue's leadership required people to sign up in advance. First, they allowed 10 people, then 20, then 50, then 100, and now they are allowing 125. Even at that number, given the size of the synagogue sanctuary, it still feels somewhat empty because we can spread out pretty easily, Rabbi Jeffrey Abraham said. Attendees must wear masks. Plexiglass will remain behind the podiums on the Bima until July 1st. Abraham joined the Conservative Synagogue last June in the midst of the pandemic. He visited the previous January before the virus had shut down much of the world, so he got a glimpse of what a normal Shabbat in the community felt like, he said. "We're getting back closer to that," said Abraham, who moved to St. Louis from a San Antonio synagogue. "As we have expanded the services beyond 100 people, a Shabbat morning feels more like it used to for me." The other local conservative synagogue, Kol Rinah, also began holding in-person services in August with limited capacity and pre-registration required. Rabbi Noah Arnau said it has been really nice to have notice of who is coming so that he can seek people out and say hello. But he is also interested to see what services would be like if the congregation were to require proof of vaccination and then gather indoors in larger numbers, without masks, and serve food. The synagogue's reopening task force planned to meet this week to discuss changes. "We are thinking about also how to celebrate B'nai Mitzvah and other simchas with families who want to celebrate and have food, and also how to have a bigger crowd on the high holidays," he said. "That opportunity to eat food together is a vital part of congregational life," said Rabbi Ze'ev Smason of the Orthodox Synagogue Nusach Ari B'nai Zion. "I have often said that I believe the kiddush and the lunch and the food that we serve at the end of service is as important as the actual service. Now, I do tell people that doesn't mean you can just come for kiddush," Smason joked. After the CDC changed its guidelines and the synagogue's medical advisory board met, the congregation, on Shavuot, when dairy food is traditionally eaten, served food for the first time during the pandemic. They offered cheesecake and grape juice. "It was delirium," Smason said. 14 months where people couldn't drink a drop of water, and now we had little cubes of cheesecake, and it felt like a 5-star meal. The opportunity to be able to interact and talk about how fascinating the rabbi's sermon was," Smason and the reporter again laughing here, "that's what it's all about. There is a lot to be happy about and a lot to smile about." At Sher Emeth, people are also smiling a lot when they see others without masks at the temple or around the Jewish community, Bennett said. Still, Bennett believes that society is experiencing a pandemic-induced agoraphobia, which the Mayo Clinic defines as a type of anxiety disorder in which you fear and avoid places or situations that might cause you to panic and make you feel trapped, helpless, or embarrassed. Given that, he is calling for his congregants and others to be patient with one another. We seem to have become accustomed to being separate, isolated, and cautious, as has been appropriate throughout the pandemic so far, Bennett said. Now the challenges include respecting the choices of others and remaining kind, compassionate, and decent towards one another. For example, while the CDC says that those who are fully vaccinated may safely go without a mask, we need to recognize that others may not feel safe yet doing so. So we ask people not to judge those who may choose to continue wearing masks. Amid the uncertainty over how people would react to restrictions, CRC leaders went back and forth on whether to require proof of vaccinations in order to attend services, Bogard said. The congregation ultimately decided to hold services on Friday nights, outdoors, with masks, and Saturday mornings, indoors, proof of vaccination required, masks and social distancing optional. We've gotten no pushback and entirely just people who are incredibly supportive of the idea that we're checking vaccination status, because I think there are a lot of folks who understandably have a lot of anxiety and fear about reentering the world without masks, Bogard said. He likened the process of reentering the normal world to the Jewish tradition of sitting Shiva for 7 days, at home, after the death of a close relative, and of Shloshim, the 30-day period in which mourners resume some social and professional interactions. It's part of our obligation to help people along this journey. Here are some of the best Jewish LGBTQIA+ books for kids of all ages. The Jewish Light Staff. The month of June is Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Questioning, Queer, Intersex, Asexual, Pansexual, and Allies, LGBTQIA+, Pride Month. Originally designed to honor the 1969 Stonewall Riots in Manhattan, which were a major turning point for LGBTQ issues in the United States. In recent years, Pride Month is observed in communities across the country with parades, festivals, and other joyful events that celebrate the LGBTQ community. Last year, our partners at Keveller went looking for new ways to mark the month by providing ways for Jewish families to teach the meanings behind Pride to children of all ages. In her piece, writer Lior Zaltzman sadly acknowledged that, "I'm a bit sad at how sparse and not Jewish this list is when we have so many amazing queer Jewish icons to look up to. From Magnus Hirschfeld to Harvey Milk to Edith Windsor, Jews have been intricately tied to groundbreaking LGBT activism. I'd love some books celebrating these Jewish icons." But for now, here's Zaltzman's list of some books celebrating Jewish icons and Jewish queer kids and families. Happy Pride and happy reading. For young readers, Heather Has Two Mommies, Daddy, Papa, and Me, and Mommy, Mama, and Me, by Leslie Newman. Jewish children's book author Leslie Newman was the first to create a children's book with lesbian characters in 1989. Heather Has Two Mommies is an iconic piece of LGBTQ children's literature history. However, Newman's other books about queer parents and kids are equally worth checking out. While none of these are Jewish, they are a great way to add diversity to your kids' library from very early on. Harvey Milk and the Rainbow Flag by Rob Sanders, illustrated by Stephen Salerno. With gorgeous, bright illustrations, this book celebrates the genesis of the Pride Rainbow Flag and of Jewish gay rights activist Harvey Milk. While it doesn't mention Milk's Jewishness, you, as a parent, most certainly can, as writer Marjorie Ingle suggests in this great review. What Makes a Baby by Corey Silverberg, illustrated by Fiona Smith. Jewish sexuality educator Corey Silverberg wrote this great book about where babies come from, whether it's adoption, IVF, or, you know, sex. It is also gender neutral and inclusive. It's truly the best way to have that birds and the bees talk in a way that really reflects the myriad ways families are made. The Purim Superhero by Elizabeth Kushner, illustrated by Mike Byrne. This delightful kids' book is about a child struggling with a Purim costume dilemma. Should he dress up like an alien, which is what he wants to do, or like a superhero, which is what all of his friends are doing? In the end, he makes a surprising decision with some help from his two dads. This Jewish children's book was part of a Keshet-sponsored initiative. The Flower Girl Wore Celery by Merrill G. Gordon, illustrated by Holly Clifton Brown. Emma is excited to celebrate her cousin Hannah's wedding, but everything she imagines the wedding to be, including expecting an actual bear to be the ring bearer, is not at all so. That also includes the groom, who turns out to be a bride. The Jewish children's book was part of a Keshet-sponsored initiative. I Am Jazz, written by Jessica Herthel and Jazz Jennings, illustrated by Shelagh McNicholas. This lovely children's book tells the childhood of the story of Jazz Jennings, the iconic Jewish YouTuber, TV personality, and trans activist, and is written by Jewish author Jessica Herthel. It's not Jewish, but it does celebrate an amazing Jewish girl, now woman. For middle readers, The Misadventures of the Family Fletcher and The Family Fletcher Takes Rock Island by Dana Allison Levy. The family Fletcher has two dads, four kids, and the six of them, plus their pets, celebrate their diverse religious and cultural backgrounds. One of the dads is Jewish, the other is Episcopalian, and the Fletcher kids' Hindu and African-American birth backgrounds are all honored in this loving, multicultural family, whose adventures are truly a delight. Lily and Duncan by Donna Gephardt. This story of a friendship between a bipolar Jewish teen, Duncan, and Lily, who is trans. The two become the keepers of each other's secrets in this moving middle reader tale. For young adults, Being Jazz, My Life as a Transgender Teen by Jazz Jennings. The trans activist's autobiography isn't super Jewish, but it does mention her family's battle with her Jewish day school to use her preferred pronouns and mentions Jewish holidays. You Asked for Perfect by Laura Silverman. Arielle Stone is bisexual, very Jewish, and a total overachiever. After a failed calculus test, his classmate, Amir Naeem, who is gay and comes from a Pakistani Muslim family, agrees to tutor him. The two teens quickly fall for each other, but between the pressures of family, school, and newfound romance, something has got to give. Wide Awake by David Levithan. Gay Jewish writer David Levithan has plenty of Jewish characters in his many novels, but Wide Awake is probably the most Jewish of them all. After Abraham Stein, who may or may not be inspired by Jewish queer icon Gertrude Stein, wins the U.S. presidential elections, making him the first Jewish and gay U.S. president, 17-year-old gay and Jewish teen Duncan Weiss rejoices. But then, the governor of Kansas calls the results of the election into question, and Weiss and his boyfriend Jimmy decide to go out there and protest. It's a book about the power of political activism, which seems especially relevant nowadays. It's a Whole Spiel, edited by Catherine Locke and Laura Silverman. This anthology features 14 stories about modern Jewish teens, and quite a few of them are about queer teens. It's a great and diverse group of Jewish voices, according to writer L.C. Rosen. The New Queer Conscience by Adam Eli. Adam Eli, a Jewish queer organizer who founded the activism group Voices 4, wrote this essential pocketbook for queer teens, all about queer responsibility and activism. He leans on his Jewish faith to explain the importance of kindness, support, and social justice. Little and Lion by Brandy Colbert. This coming-of-age story about Suzette, who is black, Jewish, and bisexual, and her relationship with her stepbrother Lionel, who has bipolar disorder, is a phenomenal and important read. Jack of Hearts by L.C. Rosen. Jack Rothman, the hero of Jack of Hearts, is Jewish, but that's not really part of his story. For Jack, who is hardly the only openly gay student in his private Manhattan high school, having sex is just an important and usually joyful part of his teen life. That is, until a mysterious and cruel anonymous blackmailer tries to get him to stop sleeping with other people. Jack of Hearts is a wonderfully sex-positive book and truly a great book for all queer Jewish teens. In the book, Jack writes an anonymous sex advice column as Jack of Hearts, and his sex advice is spot on. As author Rosen told me, queer kids need to see healthy, realistic sex scenes and also need to get their sex ed from somewhere. Camp by L.C. Rosen. A queer book about camp. Does it get any more Jewish than that? Three of the main characters in camp are incidentally Jewish, though the book takes place at a queer camp. It's an amazing exploration of how toxic masculinity can enter even the safest of safe places, and it's also a beautiful romance. Bonus: The Frog and Toad, books by Arnold Lobel. One cannot write a queer reading list without mentioning Frog and Toad, written by iconic Jewish writer and illustrator Lobel. The books, which chronicle the beautiful relationship between a frog and a toad and their many adventures, are possibly, or in my opinion, definitely, about gay love. Lobel's daughter agrees. They are of the same sex, and they love each other. It was quite ahead of its time in that respect. News and Schmooze by editor Ellen Futterman. St. Louis artist explores intersection of literary and visual arts. Joan Levinson's current show at the Kranzberg Arts Foundation's High-Low Gallery in Grand Center, Language Arts, is about the connection between literary and visual arts. Her works display certain words. Prologue, insistence, and into are a few examples. On complex canvases that Levinson builds and shapes from scratch, including the wood frames. From afar, her stark white pieces look almost stone-like, given their thickness and sculptural nature, as she sometimes combines two or more canvases in one piece. But as you move closer, traces of color rise through the white veneer, a technique Levinson seems to have perfected by building the surface with 30 or more translucent layers of oil paint. It is a painstaking process that requires patience and time. She said her pieces take about 6 months from start to finish. I'm fascinated with the physical properties of the oil paint itself, said Levinson while she was in St. Louis, her hometown, to install her show, which runs through June 26th. The materials, the pigments, of oil paints are made from parts of the earth, minerals of various sorts, nothing artificial. To get the painting to look like it does, I have to understand those properties. The words she highlights in each painting matter as well. Words have to do with my interest in grammar. Sentence structure and rhythm. Meaning is important, too. Meaning is essential to words, but they are all about being ambiguous, like intransitive verbs. It's not just a verb. There are nuances. I did a whole series of prepositions, because they are usually very small words, but serve such an important purpose in establishing time, place, and the relationship between things. The middle of three sisters, Levinson grew up in Olivet. Her parents still live there, graduated from Ladue Horton Watkins High School, and attended Temple Emmanuel. She received her bachelor's degree in fine arts from the University of Kansas in 1978 and her master's at Kranberg Art Academy in 1981. She moved to New York in 1990 and now lives in Brooklyn with her husband, a retired hospital administrator. Language Arts was supposed to open in October but got pushed back because of the pandemic. Levinson, who works part-time as a writing coach for nurses at a public hospital in Brooklyn, said she used lockdown to spend more time in her studio to create. And while all the work in her 13-piece show at the High-Low is for sale, that's not where she's focusing her energy. Success is when people come to see my work, she said. I want people to see it and have a reaction. I hope it makes them happy. For more information about the High-Low, 3301 Washington Avenue, including its hours of operation and Levinson's show, go to KranzbergArtsFoundation.org. Artist's Statement About Language Arts Show. Joan Levinson's minimalist works are a confluence of art and language, an exploration of linguistic structure and grammar, as well as of similarities between visual and literary arts. Building sentences is both a narrative and visual experience, a meeting of logic and lyric. She is fascinated with painting technique and the physical qualities of different pigments and oil media. The paintings in the exhibit have 30 or more translucent layers of oil paint, which accumulate into a complex surface that is filled with light and hints of color. The constructed shaped canvases emphasize the objectness of the work and all its elements. They cross boundaries into sculpture. These works confront the transitory nature of being, here and not here. Is our imagination just as real as the physical world around us? The paintings hover against the wall, sometimes appearing solid as stone with their surface, shape, and depth, yet nearly disappearing in their whiteness. The silvery words convey meaning, but also shimmer as pattern and shape, and sometimes get lost in the background. Some of the works emphatically assert their presence in the world, while others live in a more ambiguous realm, a place in between. The world has turned completely askew with the devastation caused by the coronavirus. Everything that we depended on, that we thought we knew to be true, has changed. These paintings began as an abstract theory about the transient nature of reality, but as the many months have passed, that theory has turned out to be frighteningly real. Find a love connection with Interstate Jewish Speed Date. How far are you willing to travel for a date with a nice Jewish fill-in-the-blank? Now's your chance to find out. If you're single, Jewish, in your late 20s, 30s, or 40s, and living in the upper Midwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Iowa, Indiana, Ohio, and Missouri, Interstate Jewish Speed Date on Sunday, June 13th at 7 p.m. can help you meet potential dates who are actually living within driving distance. Our friends at TC Jewfolk in the Twin Cities teamed up with the Filter Off app and Jewish engagement partners all over the upper Midwest, including the Jewish Light, for this casual, low-pressure, virtual event where you can talk to multiple folks you might be interested in getting to know, face-to-face, without any swiping. Signing up is simple. Register in just a minute by visiting http://tiny.cc/Interstate Jewish Speed Date. Download the video speed dating app and mark yourself as attending. You'll be reminded when the event is coming up, and then all you need to do is show up on screen and spend a few minutes chatting with up to 10 potential dates face to face. If you both want to keep talking, you'll be connected at the end of the event. This event is LGBTQ+ friendly and in the interest of advanced transparency. The platform being used has male, female, other options for gender, and allows you to indicate interest in men, women, both. Organizers know this isn't ideal and have asked the app developers if or when they will be improving this feature. If this is not a planned improvement, organizers will consider another platform for future events. There's a nominal registration fee of $5 in order to get a more solid commitment from registrants, with all the money going to challah for hunger. However, a prompt in the registration allows anyone with a financial barrier to participate to reach out to register for free. As the tagline for this event goes, love may be around the bend. Camp Sabra seeking summer staffers. Camp Sabra is currently looking for summer staff who want to forge friendships, create lasting memories, and build skills for the future. Camp Sabra is hiring counselors, specialists, unit heads, lifeguards, rope staff, and ski staff. Each summer, Camp Sabra brings more than 150 summer staff to the Steinberg Peninsula on the Lake of the Ozarks to help ensure campers have great camp experiences and build future leaders for the community. The pandemic brings a unique set of challenges to summer camp in 2021. While staff will fulfill traditional camp roles, creating fun and joyful programming and experiences for campers, they're also charged with new tasks. They will be creating a safe and kind environment for a summer of campers who've lived through an incredibly challenging year. They will supervise the initial quarantining of cabins upon campers' arrival, and they will make sure all hygiene protocols are strictly followed. Spending your summer at camp has always been important, but this year it is especially important, said Terry Grossman, director of Camp Sabra. Imagine after a year of isolation, loss of rites of passage and staying in, Camp Sabra will be a place to be outdoors, live with hundreds of friends in a community, and play on the lake. To prepare for this summer, all staff will arrive at camp at least 14 days before campers to quarantine, and they will also be provided with 2 weeks of all-staff training. Each Camp Sabra staff member will learn CPR and first aid, certified by the Red Cross, and will be trained on everything from emergency procedures to how to handle camper issues to health procedures and protocols. Camp Sabra is working to make the staff experience even more rewarding, planning additional staff relaxation areas, staff activities, catered meals, and more to provide much-deserved off-time experiences for staff. For more information about working at Camp Sabra, contact Ben Pennett, Assistant Director of Staffing and Programming at Camp Sabra, 314-442-3270, 314-442-3270, or Ben at campsabra.com. More information can also be found at campsabra.com/staff. Telushkin to speak on his biography of Chabad Rebbe. Robert A. Cohn, Editor-in-Chief Emeritus. Rabbi Joseph Telushkin, author of numerous best-selling books on Jewish history, culture, ethics, and humor, will discuss his definitive 2014 biography of Rabbi Menachem M. Schneerson, whom he calls the most influential rabbi in modern history, during a virtual program, 7:30 p.m., Wednesday, June 9th. The program, Optimism and Positive Thinking, is planned by the 5 St. Louis area Chabad centers and co-sponsored by the Jewish Federation of St. Louis, the Jewish Community Center, and the Jewish Community Relations Council. Rabbi Schneerson, 1902 to 1994, was the 7th Rebbe of the worldwide Chabad Lubavitch movement, which he took over in 1951 and built up into a worldwide movement with Chabad centers and programs in nearly every country and communities worldwide, including Chabad of Greater St. Louis, which is directed by Rabbi Yosef Landa. The Jewish Light caught up with Telushkin for an interview. The topic of your talk is optimism and positive thinking. How can Jews be optimistic and positive amid the shocking rise in anti-Semitism in America and worldwide? What do you think the Rebbe would say to Jews around the world?
The very choice we make to be optimistic is the very choice that will help defeat a pessimistic outcome. In the final analysis, only optimists can achieve something, because pessimists give up.
What attracted you to want to write the book Rebbe?
The Rebbe was the rarest kind of leader. Historically speaking, it's highly unusual for a religious leader to inspire so many millions of new people, Jews and non-Jews, so many years after his passing. I think it was this recognition that got me thinking that this topic deserves further exploration.
What is the Rebbe's enduring legacy?
His teachings and his unique message of love for every Jew, a completely unconditional love, a love without limits, a love that extended to all human beings. One of the more universal teachings of the Rebbe is his approach to education, which has a strong emphasis on moral education. I believe it was influenced by the fact that the Rebbe was studying in Berlin, in a highly respected educational institution, as Hitler was coming to power. The shortcomings of such an educational system were glaringly obvious to him.
What unique gifts and skills did the Rebbe possess that made him become the most influential rabbi in modern history?
The Rebbe was felt to be the rabbi of all Jews. You didn't have to be in his court, so to say, to seek his guidance or learn from his teachings. A story to help illustrate this point. Every Friday morning, the New York Times had a classified ad on its front page. The little box, sponsored by Chabad, noted the week's Shabbat candlelighting time and encouraged Jewish women and girls to take part. In shul, I sit next to Ari Goldman, a former reporter with the Times. He once shared with me that on January 1st, 2000, the Times printed three cover pages. Its front cover from January 1st, 1900, the actual cover of that day's paper, and a fictional one dated January 1st, 2100. And with its fictional cover falling out on a Friday, the editor had called Chabad to get the candlelighting times for 2100 and included the ad calling on Jewish women and girls to light the Shabbat candles. We don't know what will happen in the year 2000, it occurred to me. But of one thing all Jews are certain. In the year 2100, there will be Chabad representatives throughout the world encouraging Jewish women to light Shabbat candles. This explains why so much of the support for Chabad comes from people who may not directly affiliate with Chabad. This is also a part of what made the Rebbe unique, both his long-term vision and his belief that anything worth doing is worth doing now. Why was Rabbi Schneerson so opposed to marches and other public pressure on the former Soviet Union? In the course of researching my book, I learned things I hadn't known. That the Rebbe, despite his fervent opposition to demonstrations, was a more nuanced and practical thinker on the issue of how to help Russian Jews than many people, I being one of them, realized. The Rebbe knew how vicious the communists were. They, for all practical purposes, had killed his father. He feared that marches and public pressure would result in more oppression for the Jews in Russia, though he opposed anti-Soviet demonstrations, in quiet, out of earshot of the Russians, and in addition to the secret work he was spearheading to maintain Jewish life inside Russia, he found ways to cooperate with those who supported them. I write about this in the book. Are there some anecdotes that illustrate the Rebbe's universal appeal beyond the Jewish community? It wasn't only Jews whom the Rebbe loved, and non-Jews came to know that. In 1968, Shirley Chisholm became the first black woman elected to Congress. Chisholm soon found herself being relegated to a Congressional Agriculture Committee, an intentionally absurd appointment for a representative from Brooklyn. The Rebbe's office reached out to Chisholm and invited her to meet with him. "What a blessing God has given you," the Rebbe said. "This country has so much surplus food, and there are so many hungry people, and you can use this gift God has given you to feed hungry people. Find a creative way to do it." The opportunity soon arose for Chisholm, a Democrat, to work with Senator Bob Dole, a Republican, to address the needs of farmers whose food surplus meant they produced more than could be sold and who were taking a financial loss on their crops. In doing so, Chisholm was able to expand the food stamps program and played a more critical role in the creation of WIC. And Chisholm wasn't the only one. Ronald Reagan, Robert Kennedy, and Yitzhak Rabin, as well as the likes of Elie Wiesel, Herman Wouk, and Bob Dylan, all sought the Rebbe's counsel. Optimism and Positive Thinking with guest speaker Rabbi Joseph Telushkin. When? Wednesday, June 9th, 7:30 p.m. Where? Via Zoom. How much? Free and open to the public. More information? RSVP required by visiting www.showmechabad.com/Telushkin. St. Louis's Remarkable Stories from the Holocaust. Sanford and Michael Asher. Special for the Jewish Light. Since 1979, Vida Sister Goldman Prince has been chairman of the Oral Histories Project at the St. Louis Kaplan Feldman Holocaust Museum. The project is dedicated to recording and preserving audio interviews of not only Holocaust survivors, but also liberators of Nazi concentration camps and other non-Jewish witnesses living in Europe during World War II. The museum was one of the first to begin gathering oral history projects, so these voices and photographs will be displayed, and future generations will continue to be witnesses to this catastrophic period of world history.
In partnership with the Jewish Light, the St. Louis Kaplan Feldman Holocaust Museum is allowing us to republish a portion of these oral histories project as a celebration of life and a crucial part of honoring and remembering the past. Please follow the provided links to additional recordings. A brief bio. In their interview, the Asher brothers speak of the debilitating impact of having Holocaust survivors as parents, particularly their feelings of isolation as children and the fear of someone killing them. Born 10 years apart, Sanford and Michael have somewhat different stories of growing up in St. Louis. Together, they went to Sokolov Podlaski, Poland, where their mother, Pearl, grew up. They experienced open anti-Semitism on their visit. This allowed them to have a better understanding of their mother. Their testimony is candid, insightful, and chilling. Pearl Asher's testimony is also in our archives. For those interested, they can go to stljewishlight.org, access this page, and there is a taped recording of Sanford and Michael Asher's oral history. To view the full St. Louis Kaplan Feldman Holocaust Museum Oral Histories Archive, go to https://stlholocaustmuseum.org/survivor-stories/oral-histories. This year's Jewish Film Fest has a new leader at the helm, Kate Marquis, special to the Jewish Light. This is the Jewish Film Festival's 26th year, but its first without Zelda Sparks, who retired as Director of Cultural Arts at the Jewish Community Center. Sparks helped start the festival and steered it for 25 years, and this year's festival is dedicated to her. Diane Meyer, Director of Film and Performing Arts at the J, and who is taking the reins of the festival from Sparks, has warm words about her. "Zelda is a dear friend and has been there to guide me along the way," Meyer said. "She is the best, and I adore her." Festival co-chair Marilyn Brown said, "Zelda is not only a very professional, dedicated person, she's also a very dear friend. I really miss working with her on the festival and seeing her all the time. She was always available for questions, problems, etc., and she knew how to handle difficult situations with grace." Co-chair Jeffrey Korn said, "Zelda is one of a kind, and in my opinion, a loss to our film festival. But Diane is doing a marvelous job. She certainly will be a great replacement." Co-chair Paula Seigel praised Meyer as well as Sparks. "Diana Meyer had a difficult act to follow," Seigel said. "Walking in Zelda's footsteps is a tall order. Diane met the challenge head-on and turned this past year's festival into a wonderful and successful event." Brown said, "Diane is a terrific choice to step into Zelda's shoes. She brings new insights into the festival, and like Zelda, she's always there to help with any issues that arise." Meyer called it an honor to direct the festival. "We have the most amazing committee, and the festival co-chairs are completely hands-on," she said. "They work together effortlessly and have helped me throughout this entire experience. Film festival film screeners Jay Goldstein and Julie Frankel go above and beyond. They watch and screen films for the entire committee, streamlining the process, eliminating the films that we don't need to see." Curtain going up on 26th Jewish Film Festival. Kate Marquis. The St. Louis Jewish Film Festival returns in June for its 26th year, again offering wonderful films from around the world. Like last year, the festival is online, but it's back in its usual early summer slot and is taking place June 6th through 13th. The festival's Virtual Home Edition 2.0 means participants can watch the films at any time during the festival dates, with a household watching for a single admission price. While many of us miss the theater experience, it's hard to beat the virtual festival for convenience.
"It seems audiences like virtual," said Jeffrey Korn, co-chair of the Jewish Film Festival. "Response has been great, although personally, I like the theater showings. But virtual is much less expensive, and the nice thing about virtual is that you can watch at your leisure. Korn is one of three co-chairs with Marilyn Brown and Paula Seigel. Diane Meyer, Director of Film and Performing Arts at the Jewish Community Center of St. Louis, is taking over as Festival Director from Zelda Sparks, who's retired from her position as Cultural Arts Director at the J. All films will be viewed through the festival's screening platform, events.jccstl.com. Information on accessing films will be sent with ticket or pass purchases. Technical help is available at the festival website, stljewishfilmfestival.org, and live tech help will be available during the festival run. I would strongly suggest that our patrons try accessing the films maybe an hour before they actually plan to view them, just to be sure they don't run into any problems, Brown said. But there is help available at the J. All of the films except one will be available to view any time during the festival. The Israeli documentary Breaking Bread is only available June 6th through 8th. Having a virtual festival allows viewers to watch the film any time they want, day or night, Meyer said. You can pause the film to get a snack, or you can stop it and have 48 hours to resume. It's really fantastic. As always, the St. Louis Jewish Film Festival offers a broad selection of films with Jewish themes. The festival offers a great variety of types of films, features, comedies, dramas, documentaries, so there's something for everyone, Brown said. 13 films will be shown, plus a bonus film for all access pass holders, the documentary short, Egg Cream, about the famous Jewish American treat. Films are from Israel, Austria, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Norway, and the United States, and in a mix of languages with English subtitles. The 13 include 6 full-length documentaries and 7 narrative feature films, including a docudrama, and range from comedy to romance to drama. Asked for their favorites among this year's films, Korn and Meyer named Alci, a documentary about the up-and-down life of basketball star Alci Perry, one of Israel's greatest athletes. The showing will include an interview with the film's director, Danny Menken, by Larry Levin, executive director of Ozark Land Trust and former publisher CEO of The Jewish Light. Interviews this year will be pre-recorded so viewers can watch them at any time after viewing the film. Meyer said, A Starry Sky Above the Roman Ghetto is another favorite. The Italian young adult drama tells the story of how the photo of a little girl sparks a group of present-day Jewish and Christian teens to uncover what happened in the Roman Jewish ghetto during the Shoah. Meyer also singled out Kiss Me Kosher, a cross-cultural romantic comedy about the wedding of a same-sex couple, as well as Love It Was Not, an astonishing Israeli-Austrian documentary about a forbidden love in Auschwitz. Korn said he especially enjoyed Here We Are, a sensitive drama from Israeli director Nir Bergman about a father and his autistic adult son who sort out how they feel about the son moving to a group home during a cross-country bike trip. And The Crossing, a dramatic Norwegian family feature about 4 children during World War II trying to flee occupying Nazis and get to Sweden. Siegel, the third co-chair, also has favorites. I loved Breaking Bread, she said of a documentary about a food festival that pairs Israeli and Muslim chefs, started by a woman who was the first Israeli Muslim to win top prize on MasterChef Israel, a reality TV show. The film, she said, is a look into Israelis and Muslims working together in peace and friendship. The show will feature a discussion with Ben Paremba, a local award-winning chef, restaurateur, who will be interviewed by Ellen Futterman, editor-in-chief of the St. Louis Jewish Light. Also recommended was the feature film Service to Man, which, it was said, is a true story of reverse discrimination when a Jewish male is accepted into an all-black medical school. A very timely film, and a film conversation will take place discussing this topic. Brown said she highly recommends the documentary Antisemitism. The history is fascinating, and even though the film concentrates on anti-Semitism in France, it presents a very detailed history of how this venom came about. The film also has a discussion with Karen Aresti, longtime director of ADL Heartland, and Mara Cohen, Ionides, of Missouri State University. Meyer said a tremendous amount of work goes into selecting films for the annual festival. We watch tons of films, meet to discuss every single film, and when the time comes, we try to choose the greatest variety and the best overall films, she said. We start with so many films that the 13 we wound up with are all fantastic. Other films in this year's festival include Howie Mandel, But Enough About Me, is a Canadian documentary about the comedian that promises to bring a smile as well as to touch the heart, exploring his career and his battles with mental illness. Israeli documentary Ma'abarot reveals the little-known history of Jewish refugees from the Middle East and North Africa who faced discrimination and hardship when they arrived in Israel in the 1950s. The Good Nazi is a Canadian-Israeli docudrama about the true story of Nazi Major Karl Plage, who secretly sheltered hundreds of Jews in Lithuania. The Last Supper is a German drama about a Jewish-German family gathering for a dinner on the day Hitler comes to power. The father doesn't take Hitler seriously, but things are changing. When a daughter announces her plan to move to Israel, the dinner takes a fractious turn. The festival is hoping to draw even more patrons than last year's virtual film fest. The festival last November was very successful, and we hope our patrons will be just as pleased with this program, Brown said. Our dedicated committee and JCC staff have worked for many months to put together a diverse roster of films, and I hope we'll retain our previous viewers and attract new viewers this year. St. Louis Jewish Film Festival. When? June 6th through 13th. Where? Virtual. How much? Tickets for individual films are $14 for the entire household, and All Access Pass offers all 13 films plus a bonus short film for $95 per household. More info. Tickets and passes can be purchased at stljewishfilmfestival.org. It is recommended to buy tickets early, as the films have a limit at which they are considered sold out. For more information about the festival, call 314-442-3190. 314-442-3190. How a woke storm is misleading a generation about Israel. This article originally appeared on the New York Jewish Week. Just a few weeks ago, the streets of New York City were filled with thousands of people shouting Intifada, while also claiming Black Lives Matter. In that same period, a violent pro-Palestinian mob attacked Jews on the streets of New York. Others violently assaulted Jews at a restaurant in Los Angeles, vandalized European synagogues, and targeted Jews in Chicago and Montreal. Normally, unprovoked attacks against another group of people would be widely condemned and its perpetrators called out for what they are. But these attacks were tied to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, so many on the left defended them in the name of freedom of assembly and freedom of speech, or worse, by suggesting that the victims somehow deserved it. In light of the recent violence in Israel and Gaza, woke warriors today are rehashing their charges of apartheid, claiming Israel is a white supremacist society seeking to subvert and cleanse its Palestinian population. But something far more insidious is happening as well in Jewish communities all over the world. Jew haters are using the conflict in the Middle East as an excuse to unleash their unabashed hatred of Jews wherever they dwell. How can honest advocates for justice condone such violent attacks against a people? The answer is a simple one, though many refuse to accept it. Anti-Semitism is socially acceptable among the woke. Or to put it in boomers' terms, apparently Jewish blood is still cheap. Nearly 80 years ago, Jewish children were burned in ovens under German state-sponsored terrorism while the world shrugged. The world is still shrugging as Israeli children go to sleep in bomb shelters, fearful for their lives and well-being. Israelis come in all colors and creeds. Look at Lod, Haifa, and Acre, the multi-ethnic, multicultural cities of Arabs and Jews torn apart by rioting during last month's conflict. It is because Israel strives to be a country of all its inhabitants, including 2 million Arab citizens, that the unrest is being treated as an internal crisis, and politicians have condemned Jewish vigilantes and Arab rioters. Israeli Jews are roughly divided between Ashkenazi Jews with roots in Europe and Sephardi or Mizrahi Jews with roots around the Mediterranean and the Middle East, who in turn were descendants of Jews from the Holy Land, going back hundreds and thousands of years. Claiming that Jews are white, European colonizers of Israel, as woke activists frequently do, is about as historically honest as saying Native Americans don't have a right to live in the United States. Unfortunately, segments of the Jewish population are some of the most vocal supporters of this fraudulent ideology, trading our people for acceptance, forgetting our own history for the expediency of being politically correct. Jewish Currents magazine would have us believe that Israel still needs to perform teshuvah, repentance, for providing safe haven to Jews in 1948. Forget that countless Arab countries expelled their Jews then. If not now, questions whether Zionism, the movement for Jewish self-determination, the movement that gave birth to a country where more than 7 million fellow Jews now live, should be, quote, a core part of our Jewish identity, end quote. Jewish Voice for Peace considers Zionism, quote, a false and failed answer, end quote, to centuries of murderous anti-Semitism. It seems that portions of our people have forgotten why Israel was established in the first place, to serve as a safe haven for Jews in our own ancestral homeland. Clearly that need is as vital today as it was in the 1930s and before. Instead, the Jewish woke equate Tikkun Olam with Intifada, and in doing so, pervert Jewish values to a sickening extreme, aligning themselves not just with Palestinians with legitimate grievances and a vision for a shared future, but with people who seek the destruction of the Jewish people wherever they may live. Note, Hamas doesn't just want Israel, Judenrein, but the whole world. Of course, Jewish fanaticism is abhorrent. Like any democracy, Israel has its religious and political extremes. As a rabbi, I've spoken against the Prime Minister's inclusion of militant parties in his coalition and denounced bigotry and violence from wherever it may stem. The current anti-Zionist moment is not about that. It is about rejecting one people's claims to a land in favor of another's, a mirror image of the apartheid label they attach to Israel. Of course, Palestinian lives matter. Even Alan Dershowitz said that much before Bernie Sanders realized he could co-opt a woke slogan. How profoundly unfortunate it is that the Palestinian leadership continues to undermine its own people's well-being, repeatedly rejecting peace accords with Israel, and most recently, refusing its own people democratic elections. Let's remember that the Palestinian Prime Minister is still serving a 4-year term that started in 2006. The Israeli-Arab conflict is a decades-long, complex one. But woke culture sees no nuance, only supremacist and victim. Many of the leading lights of the Democratic Party amplify this mess. If only Bernie could listen to Bernie from 2014 telling protesters that Hamas uses Gazan children as shields. Common sense isn't what it used to be. And of course, Judaism advocates for a certain kind of wokeness. Judaism instructs us to pursue justice constantly. But the prophets of the Hebrew Bible were not only the most adamant in calling for a righteous society, but in creating a generous one too. Do justice, love kindness, walk humbly with your God, the prophet Micah charged. It seems that today's generation has forgotten Micah's last sentiment. Woke culture is in desperate need of humility, admitting that truth does not dwell in Twitter, nor the Messiah in a meme. If the woke community really sought to awaken, it would realize that the Jew hatred is the oldest of hatreds. Of all the countries in the world with egregious human rights records, how is it that the State of Israel, which has Arab members of Knesset and an LGBTQ parade in Jerusalem, is so often singled out by the United Nations for reprimand. Which other country on the planet would tolerate a daily barrage of missiles aimed at its civilian populations? How can one justify the assault on non-Israelis in cities worldwide in the name of ending the occupation? It is time for the world to wake up and recognize when defense of Palestinian rights becomes a one-sided, distorted, often violent assault against Jews, plain and simple. People of conscience, and especially Jews, ought to know better. This post, How a Woke Storm is Misleading a Generation About Israel, appeared first on Jewish Telegraphic Agency. Companion Baking's Josh Allen, Writing to End Childhood Hunger. I'm ending childhood hunger in America. Can you help me? Alec Barris, Digital Engagement Associate. The COVID-19 pandemic has made childhood hunger even more concerning, and in America, with distance learning impacting many schools' ability to provide low-income children with nutritious meals on a consistent basis. To combat this, Companion Baking has sold specially branded No Kid Hungry sprouted wheat sandwich bread through partnerships with Schnucks and Fresh Time Markets over the past 8 months, raising more than $7,000. Now, Companion Baking CEO Josh Allen, who is Jewish, will continue this mission by hopping on his bicycle. On June 21st, Allen will be riding 100 miles with Chef's Cycle for No Kid Hungry in the hopes of raising $10,000. No Kid Hungry is connecting kids across the country with healthy food where they live, learn, and play, Allen said in a recent press release. Every $1 you donate can help connect a child with up to 10 meals. Allen will be riding in St. Louis with a number of other dedicated chefs, as Chef's Cycle encourages food service professionals to take on this challenge in small, safe groups at home. You can support Allen's ride by visiting https://p2p.onecause.com/chefscycle2020/companion-baking. No child in America should grow up hungry, Allen said, but many kids and too many kids in our country don't have the food they need to thrive. For the past 4 years, Chef's Cycle has engaged members of the culinary community who want to push their physical limits while raising funds and awareness in support of No Kid Hungry. To learn more about Chef's Cycle, visit www.chefscycle.org. Obituaries. Stanley Michael Mickey Schaefer, May 27th. Marlene Katz Canefield, May 21st. Linda S. Hyken, May 31st. Fern Clayman Rosenberg, May 31st. Doris May Hacker Friedman, May 30th. Joel Allen Waldman, May 30th. This has been Terry Reitzel reading the St. Louis Jewish Light.